the House Transportation Committee. And this morning, we have some invited testimony, and then we're going to tackle another bill. For committee members, we will not be meeting on Friday. No House Transportation Committee is meeting Friday. So hopefully your calendar will fill up with important events, so you can take the day off or whatever you want to do. I think we'll just start on the top of the list. And have Bob Melbo come forward and talk to us about Oregon Short Line Railroad.
Yeah.
And Kathleen Carter.
Come on, Arnold.
Chair Starr and members of the committee, my name is Robert I. Melbo, and I'm president of the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, which represents the small railroads of Oregon. We have some literature that we will be passing out to you about our organization and about the short lines in Oregon, as well as some important points about the short line industry in general in our state. It's kind of interesting to note that prior to 1980, when the Staggers Act was passed by the federal government, which deregulated the railroad industry, but prior to that time, the short line railroads in Oregon really represented a very small percentage of the rail mileage in operation. The railroad industry was clearly dominated in Oregon by the larger railroads, the so-called Class One carriers. And at that time, there were three major railroads in Oregon: the Southern Pacific, the Union Pacific, and the Burlington Northern. After 1980, the industry began to shed some of the low-density, marginal lines. These were the branch lines and the feeder lines. Some of these were abandoned. As some of you, I'm sure, are aware, we no longer have rail service into places like Seneca or Burn, and several other communities have lost rail. We've lost the railroad from Cottage Grove that ran eastward out of there into the foothills of the Cascades, and we've lost a railroad operating out of Klamath Falls called the Oregon California and Eastern. So we've had some casualties over the last 20 years or so, but the deregulation of the industry in 1980 set the stage for an explosion of short lines throughout the United States. And Oregon was kind of late to the party in this regard, because the short line growth in Oregon really didn't begin in earnest until about 1993. In that year, Southern Pacific shed a lot of its branch line mileage in the Willamette Valley. And a railroad by the name of Willamette Pacific was created to take over that operation. In 1994, Southern Pacific sold its Siskiyou line. This is the line that runs from Eugene down to Roseburg and on through Cow Creek Canyon to Grants Pass and Medford, and then on into California. That railroad was sold to a new railroad called the Central Oregon and Pacific, as was the Coos Bay branch from Eugene over to Coos Bay. In fact, the Central Oregon and Pacific today represents the largest short line railroad in the state. In 1995, Southern Pacific shed the rest of its mileage, branch line mileage in the state, which was about 53 miles of branches south and west of Portland, mostly west. And that was to a railroad called Portland and Western. And then later that same year, Burlington Northern handed over some of its branch lines in the same general area to the Portland and Western. And then the Portland and Western continued to grow in 1997 with the acquisition of the Astoria line. And today, the Portland and Western and the Willamette Pacific, which are both owned by the same holding company in Genesee and Wyoming, are operating most of the low-density branch line mileage west of Interstate 5 and north of Eugene. Now, we also have we have an interesting array of ownership in the state with the short lines. We have three actually, Central Oregon and Pacific, Willamette and Pacific, Portland and Western, that are owned by large companies that make a business of owning and operating short lines. We have some smaller short lines that are in private ownership, such as the Willamette Valley Railway and the Albany and Eastern. They're owned by families. The Oregon Pacific, which is a short line in the Portland area, is owned by a family. And then we have some short lines that are actually owned by public entities. The City of Prineville Railroad is one. The Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad, which is fairly large short line of mileage, 90-some miles, is owned obviously by the Port of Tillamook Bay. And then the Lake County owns a railroad that operates from Alturas, California, up to Lakeview. In fact, this railroad is mostly in California, but nevertheless, it's owned by the County of Lake. So we have sort of a cross-section of ownership throughout the state on the short lines. The short lines really are a vital link in Oregon's transportation network. As a result of the explosion in the growth of short lines, today more than half of the rail mileage in the state is actually operated by short line carriers. And the Class 1 carriers, which has now shrunk down to two, Union Pacific and Burlington Northern and Santa Fe, operate the rest of it. We have 19 short line and terminal railroads currently in Oregon. Over 60% of the businesses that either ship or receive commodities by rail are located on short lines. The short lines are important to the big railroads in that they provide a feeder service. I kind of liken it to a pickup and delivery service, and the big railroads are more interested in providing the long haul transportation of commodities and a kind of like wholesale transportation, where the short lines are becoming the retailers of the local service. Short lines offer the only rail transportation to one third of Oregon's ports, including Astoria, St. Helens, and Coos Bay. Short lines are currently traveling over and are maintaining about 1,120 miles of track, which is, as I said, a little over half the mileage in Oregon. This is higher than the national average of 29% in most states. In California and Washington State, short lines operate over about a third of those states' rail miles. Short lines move about 135,000 rail cars each year. That's be loaded rail cars. To put that in perspective, rail cars are equivalent to about three or four trucks as a conversion ratio. So you can multiply that by about 3.5 and come up with a number of trucks that are not operating on the state's highways as a result of the short line activity. The short lines are a vital component of Oregon's economy as businesses themselves, and also a key supporter for a range of industries that use them. Short lines create markets for Oregon companies by allowing them to compete in markets across the United States that they would not otherwise be economically able to reach with truck transportation. About 30% of the Oregon rail traffic that's generated here does head toward eastern markets. Short lines are important on the inbound flow of material, bringing raw materials from beyond Oregon's borders to farmers and manufacturers. They act as capillaries for rural economic development, providing large and small Oregon businesses with cost-efficient transportation connections to markets all over the globe. And short lines have a stake in their local communities, striving to satisfy the precise transportation needs of large and small customers, employing over 450 people themselves, and generating over $52 million in gross revenues per year, and paying over $500,000 in property taxes as well as income taxes each year. The short lines support Oregon businesses in that they purchase much of what they need from local vendors as opposed to the large railroads, which tend to buy on a national basis. For every railroad employee, there are another 1.4 Oregonians working to support him or her. Short lines purchase, of course, bridge timbers and ties, rail and signaling equipment, as well as use professional services, consume utilities, and purchase other supplies from vendors in Oregon. Short lines buy almost $4 million in fuel each year from local suppliers. Communities that depend on tax receipts from timber sales benefit from close proximity to short lines. The minimum allowable bids for timber sales set by the Forest Service are higher when the timber is close to a railroad, increasing tax receipts communities receive from these sales. However, rail service does come with a price tag. On the average, it costs about $4,000 to $5,000 per mile per year for ongoing maintenance of track. Oregon Short Lines spend together about $8 million a year on safety and upkeep of their lines. Adding to this cost burden is the cost of maintenance deferred by the previous owners. Now, the previous owners were, of course, the larger railroads, and for a while there was a prevailing notion in the industry that many of these branch lines were going to be abandoned. And as a result, the railroads were not investing in the maintenance on these lines like they would have if they had intended to keep them. But instead, they spun them off to short line operators, but unfortunately, a deferred maintenance deficit went with that. So part of the problem that our short lines have today is they're dealing with maintenance that was not done by the previous owners. And of course, that problem is aggravated by the fact that these are still low-density marginal lines that the overall character of them has not changed. Even though the short lines have been successful in getting new business, they still are dealing with low volumes, trying to cover relatively high fixed costs. ODOT, that's the ODOT rail section, recently estimated that Oregon short lines have immediate rehabilitation needs of about $32 million. And about 12% of Oregon's short line rail system is in poor condition. Another problem that's looming on the horizon is the use of the heavier rail cars that the industry is moving to. The rail industry is moving from freight cars that weigh 263,000 pounds fully loaded to cars that weigh 286,000 pounds. These take their toll on track and bridges, and the small railroads are in many cases cannot generate sufficient funds needed to upgrade the structures, bridges that is, and the track on their systems in order to handle these cars. And of course, they need to handle these cars if our rail system in this country is truly going to be a system. So a customer in the east can ship something to Oregon in a car, maximum weight car of 286,000 pounds, and have it arrive at the place where it's needed rather than to be prohibited from getting there because the short line serving the customer cannot handle the heavier car. The need to finance such infrastructure improvements was unforeseen when many of these rail lines were purchased by their current owners. Although the revenue short lines will receive from moving these heavier cars should cover the added maintenance costs, it will not be enough to pay for the required initial upgrades. Some federal and state grants are available, although the current financial support does not come close to filling the gap in what is needed to keep these important rail lines operational. Identifying new funding sources to help viable small railroads to meet the challenge of heavier cars, aging infrastructure, and inherited deferred maintenance is vital to have the short line railroads remain an integral and healthy part of Oregon's transportation system. Unlike many other states, including those that are far less dependent on short lines than Oregon, our state does not fund rail infrastructure improvements. For example, this year, Washington State will use $5.3 million from the general fund for railroad track and bridge repairs. Kansas allocates $3 million each year from its highway trust fund to pay for short line rehabilitation. Oklahoma's railroad maintenance program draws from railroad freight car gross from a railroad freight car gross receipts tax. And in 1998, Maine voters approved a transportation bond referendum that included $1.22 million for the Industrial Rail Access Program to support and enhance rail transportation in the state and stimulate the economy by supporting rail infrastructure improvements that would benefit both railroads and shippers. Some states, such as New York, encourage railroad improvements because they exempt taxes for a period of time when improvements, enhancements, and upgrades are made on railroad rail property. By contrast, in Oregon, there is a disincentive because of an increased tax liability associated with improvements made by short line operators. The situation that our short lines really find themselves in today is in many cases, the traffic is simply not able to support the improvements needed to keep the infrastructure in a satisfactory condition to support the state's economy. And as a result of this, I think that you're going to see in the next few years a crisis of sorts, in that we will have some short lines that will be on the verge of curtailing operations in certain areas unless some method can be found to help improve the condition of their track and system. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony at this point. if we were to, in Oregon, pass a law that would be similar to New York, where we'd exempt for taxes infrastructure improvements, what would that mean for our short line railroad? Kind of help with that.
Chair Starr, that would be very helpful. The New York law, if I recall correctly, exempts capital investment for 10 years, and then it goes on the tax rolls at a depreciated value, I think something like about half of what the original value was. And that would definitely be of assistance to our short line railroads here in this state. Currently, even routine track maintenance, which often is capitalized in the railroad industry, it goes on the books as increased value and has the effect of increasing the short line's taxes, when in reality it's probably nothing more than it would be similar to you putting a new roof on your house to keep it from leaking. I mean, it's one thing to have remodel your house, and obviously you would expect the value of it to go up. But it's something else if you do just normal or ordinary maintenance on your house and you find that your assessed value goes up because of that. And that's kind of what the short lines are facing today.
Follow up on that. If we don't do anything, what is the potential for some of these short lines, I mean, on a percentage basis of them being in such financial trouble that we lose more of them?
Well, I don't know that I can tell you on a percentage basis. So there are some line segments, I think, that are if they were animals, they would be endangered species. Among those, I think, would be the line from Corvallis down to Monroe and Dawson is certainly one of those. I'm concerned about the Coos Bay line, the loss of international paper a year and a half or 2 years ago. Down at Gardner has certainly turned the tables on the economics of that line. There are the far end of the Astoria line is in serious trouble with no real financial reason to be there. And line up to the Gaston area serving a Stimson Lumber Company is in pretty bad shape and may need some assistance. And there's some others, too. The Lake County just barely hanging on with their line to Lakeview. So there are several line segments that are certainly in more jeopardy than others. There are others that are in fine shape, you know, that there's adequate volume to, you know, to secure them and to provide for capital to for maintenance and improvements. But it's those line segments that, you know, are not carrying sufficient traffic that are really at risk.
Thank you. Are there any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Melville, I am a former mayor of the city of Coos Bay, so I
would like to address some things about the, also to the committee, about the emphasis that you've placed on the economic development and the part that short lines play. It is vital that that rare line stay there. When International went out, of course, we have Roseburg lumber to the south of us. One of the things that has happened in that area is that through the efforts of Congressman DeFazio, the port of Coos Bay has taken over the rail bridge, which has been a real concern to a lot of people. And there is money there now to do some restructuring of that. I also understand that Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad will be improving the line from Eugene down to Coos Bay. Their improvements before have been from Eugene down to Ashland. And so that, again, is very good news. I'd like to emphasize that they did inherit a very bad situation from the former owner, who absolutely let the lines just completely go. So the one question that I have for you is that are you familiar with the opening there at the bridge as these ships are being built now, bigger and bigger, the size of an airline, airplane? Do you know if that rail bridge is an impediment to navigation in the future?
Representative Berger and Chair Starr, I believe that the North Bend Drawbridge, which is the bridge you're talking about there at the entrance to Coos Bay Harbor, it's kind of interesting. When it was built in 1913, it was the largest center swing span railroad drawbridge in the world. But a lot of things have happened in the world since then. And I believe that the opening now is somewhat of an impediment to navigation. Similar to the Burlington Northern Bridge across the Willamette River in Portland was a few years ago. And that was solved by converting that bridge, also a center swing span drawbridge, to a twin tower lift span, which basically then doubled the width of the channel that was available for maritime use. The only problem is that that may not be the solution at Coos Bay because of the proximity of the airport. The towers that would be needed to support the bridge might be in the flight path. I'm not sure, but I think that's one of the problems. But I do think that there may be a channel width problem at the bridge that may impair larger vessels from entering the harbor. My understanding of that is that it's pretty narrow.
The thing that concerns me about that is that, of course, the port there is vital. And as you pointed out, we lack product. And so until we can change that and get more product, we are faced with a very serious situation. And, of course, as you know, the port does own the airport as well in that area. So they probably could at least not be, not the right hand would know what the left hand is doing, is what I'm trying to say, because they do own it. But I think that we're from 300 ships in a year down to 86. So there are a lot of economic impacts that we have felt that have been very devastating to that community, and thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you. President
Bonner? Yes, Chairman Starr. My question is regarding the new cars, the size of them. 286,000 pounds for the new ones, and the old ones were, what, 263,000, you say?
Yes, sir, that's correct.
I assume that's loaded?
That's the car and the contents, yes, total weight.
And so it's a weight problem, is that correct, that the bridges and railroad can't handle?
Well, it's in some cases, on some lines, the bridges particularly may not have been built to handle a car that weighs a total of 143 tons, which that comes up, totals up to be. The other car, the previous large car, was 131.5 tons. So that's one problem, is that there are some bridges that simply may need to be strengthened in order to handle these heavier cars, that they simply can't, make that jump from 131 to 143 without something. But the other problem that the railroads have, or the short lines have, is that these heavier cars actually are harder on the railroad than their predecessors were. And the short lines, by their nature, have got rail lines that were, of course, built some time ago, and they were built to a little lighter standard for, in most cases, than the main lines in use today, you know, smaller rail and that sort of thing. So these cars do exact a much heavier maintenance toll on the rail lines than the previous cars. And so just like a much heavier truck, if it suddenly started using a residential street, would probably, you know, start to damage the street over time. So this is an ongoing problem, and that's one reason why the short lines in some cases do receive a little bit more revenue for handling these heavier cars, which is supposed to offset the additional maintenance costs, but it does not necessarily provide enough money to catch up to put the property in the condition that it needs to be in to handle the cars in the first place.
One follow-up.
Yes.
Could we just put a little less weight in each one of those? It's only about a ton difference by my figures. Do they have to be filled completely to capacity in order to be profitable, or?
Well,
a little less. Could we handle the weight on there?
It's difficult to get railroad customers to load less in the car. One of the advantages of using rail transportation and using the larger cars, of course, is that you can ship more of whatever it is you're shipping, for a reduced price to market. So most customers are loath to load less in, less in capacity into a car. I mean, the whole reason for doing it is economics. So it sort of starts to destroy the economics.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Melbo, I'm intrigued with short lines, and I think this is a great way to move freight, and since I come from the aviation freight market or freight industry, I can identify with the needs for an intermodal network. Would the efficiency and effectiveness and economies and focus of the rail business be greater served if you were your own separate entity like aviation out of ODOT?
Well, Representative Nelson and Chair Starr, I guess I would make this observation ODOT and the ODOT rail section the rail section of ODOT has been incredibly helpful and supportive of the short line industry. However, having said that, it needs to be recognized that that group is something less than 30 people in an organization that has several thousand employees and principally exists to support and nurture the highway system of our state, which is incredibly important, as we all know. But I think that as much as ODOT, I think tries to have a multimodal focus, it may be difficult at times when you're part of an overall, highway organization to be able to shift gears and think in terms of other types of transportation. So, I'm not any expert on these things, but it could be that, it could help perhaps if that organization were separate from the ODOT, the highway folks, and were off kind of seeking its own course.
Anything further, Representative Virgin?
Chair, I have a question. If you didn't in the last session, wasn't aviation moved out of ODOT?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We will have a report actually on Monday in this committee. I think that was through the 108. Okay. That last
right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. I appreciate the testimony. It's very helpful.
Okay. Thank you.
And committee members, we are planning on our agenda on Wednesday to have an overview of the rail division of ODOT. So just so you're aware of that. Well, our friends from Jackson County can come on up. John Watt, Charles Easter, and
Mike Burrell.
Very good. Welcome. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Watt. On my right, your left, is Charles Deister, who is in my office, and Mike Verl is to my left, and I'll introduce him in a moment. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committee. First of all, I must apologize to the committee for lack of written testimony, particularly Representative Nelson.
Yes.
I will pay the penalty personally for whatever you choose to mete out. The reason for that, however, is because we're here to tell a regional story today with anecdotal testimony. And I've asked Mr. Burrell, who is one of my clients we represent, in addition to Jackson County, a consortium of business people who are extremely interested in statewide transportation finance. And we thought it would be best to hear it straight from the horse's mouth. So with that, I will introduce to you the CEO and President of Burrell Resources, Mike Burrell.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and share some thoughts with you today. It's interesting to have listened to the discussions to this point. I've, in my life, spent nearly half my time on different types of transportation issues. I chair a group in the Rogue Valley called TRADCO, which stands for Transportation Advocacy Committee. We get together at least once a month and work with ODOT, the counties and cities in Jackson and Josephine counties, trying to further transportation solutions. Another part of my life, I serve on ODOT's Freight Advisory Committee, and wearing that hat, I come to Salem at least once a month, and we spend several hours each time that we're here talking about nothing but the different modes of freight, and we worry about rail, we worry about truck, we worry about our highways and our freight systems in total. And the challenge that I see in front of you and that whole subject is the interlinkage, the of the multimodal concept that we work with, from aviation that we've talked about to railroads to trucks, and how all these pieces fit together. Another part of my life is that I have been appointed to serve on the Oregon State Aviation Board. So wearing that hat, we're interested in how aviation fits into to all of these different things. Transportation, again, is not an easy solution. So often, as Mr. Melbo pointed out, we think of highways and roads, but transportation involves so much more than that. And I think back to a meeting that we had last year in Seattle with a freight group from up there, and it was pointed out that with the new super cargo container ships that are coming into the Puget Sound now, that when they unload all of the containers from one of those ships and put it on rail, it takes, I believe the number they told us was 10 trains a mile and a half long to take those containers away. Then if you stop and think about what do you do with the containers when they come off of rail, then you have trucks. So all these pieces fit together, and you can't make one solution or come up with a solution that sits in a vacuum. Port of Portland is forecasting that air cargo to the port is going to triple in the next 20 years. Right now they have in the neighborhood of 500 trucks a day that go into the cargo facility at Portland. And so you have trucks, you have airplanes, and all of that will increase. Something's got to give somewhere along the way. A couple of thoughts that, as I've listened so far this morning, and with what we've done on the Freight Advisory Committee. First of all, one thing to watch, and I believe there's some state law that helps in this, but be concerned about abandoned railroad right-of-ways. If you stop and think about the problems of building roads, just highways today, think about the problem if you were to try to go out and build a new railroad in the future. And those right-of-ways, many times, even if we aren't going to use them in the short term, maybe if you're looking out into the future, if we had them preserved in some way, they could come back around. I would state very strongly that Mr. Melbo's view of splitting the rail division out of ODOT is wrong. And my concern in doing that is, again, going back to the issue of transportation and all the different modes of transportation, we have to keep those pieces together. When aviation was split out of ODOT, one of my concerns there was that we can't pretend that there isn't a linkage, because there is a linkage, and we have to continue to talk to each other.
And I'm working very hard with the Aviation Board to try to bring that linkage together so that we do have communication, because, again, airplanes, the cargo, the passengers do affect roads and all of those things as we grow. So where does this take us? You have a big challenge in front of you. You have concerns about how we're going to finance our road systems and all the other things that you have to deal with transportation. It's not easy. The public doesn't understand, and it may not happen immediately. Somewhere along the way, we will have to face that issue, and I just wish you good luck. Thank you.
If I might just add a few things to Mr. Burrell's testimony. With regards to Southern Oregon, we've worked extremely hard to bring together partnerships in that region of the state to address all the concerns of the region. Historically, we've had some frustration in Southern Oregon about how our roads and highways have been funded, and we've realized that one of the reasons for that was because we had different entities acting singly or alone, and through the efforts of TRADCO have brought those discussions together so now that we can address our regional problems as a group and go to the Transportation Commission, and we've seen a little more success in having those things funded. We are growing in Southern Oregon, not to the degree or extent of some of the other regions of the state, certainly the metropolitan Portland area or in Bend, but our growth is sustained growth, and because for those of you who've never been to Southern Oregon, the sun shines a lot more down there than it does up here. It's a little more attractive for retired folks to come to our region of the state, and we don't anticipate, nor does anyone else, that that growth is going to stop anytime soon. That creates an infrastructure problem. We want to be able to address that problem before it becomes a critical problem. However, we see the need to join in the rest of the state to address the overall transportation issues of the state, and we're certainly not asking for any special treatment for Southern Oregon, but we want to join in the effort that identifies the need that the entire state has and help to be part of that solution that ultimately you decide in this body. So with that, once again, thank you for the time, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Burrell, do you have a knowledge of why, excuse me, let me start over. I learned not to brag. I just want the committee to know this. In a previous meeting, I was telling the story of how I'd come to Governor Goldschmidt and talked about, you know, how great it would be to have an intermodal hub out of the Port of Portland, since I understand this very much, and suggested that we focus, you know, on Taiwan and Evergreen shipping lines. Of course, no relation whatsoever to Evergreen or National Airlines or aviation in McMinnville. And then to pick up the paper and see that we were moving so far ahead on freight, and freight was, you know, the greatest percentage of revenue to the port, to the Port of Portland versus passenger business, I was bragging on this. And then a week later, you know, we're notified that Evergreen is pulling out. Do you know why?
No, not
Evergreen. And I'm talking about Evergreen shipping lines from Taiwan.
Right.
Chairman Shane.
We had our freight advisory committee meeting yesterday, and there was a brief discussion about that, and I believe that'll be an agenda item for us. The concern that I expressed at the meeting yesterday is that so often that the publics around Oregon think of the Port of Portland as being Portland. The Port of Portland is really Oregon. That is our point of connection for shipping by sea and receiving goods in and out by sea. And we have to look at that as an Oregon issue and not a Portland issue. And again, the public a lot of times does not understand that. And when it comes down to all the different impacts that might be there, whether it's dredging on the Columbia, whether it's the drawdown of the dams, and you can have all the environmental debate that you want, but someplace we have to also put into that debate what the impacts will be from our decisions economically for the state of Oregon. Because, quite frankly, yesterday I asked the manager of the Port of Coos Bay if they could bring in the large super container ships into Coos Bay, even if they didn't go through the drawbridge that we were talking about or the swing bridge, and if they were to dock along the North Spit, and they can't do that. So if we can't bring them into Portland, we're not going to bring them into Coos Bay, we're not going to bring them into Oregon. So what does that do to our economy? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up on that? To complete my question regarding Evergreen Shipping Line, so at this time you're unaware if it's because we don't have an efficient intermodal system or because Delta pulled out and we have no air service directly
to
that area, or you have no concept now, and secondly, of the why, and are they moving back to Seattle?
I don't have the answer. I'm positive it has no relationship to Delta. But I believe their concerns, from what I read in the paper, are the dredging on the Columbia, that they are concerned that it may not happen. The big new super container ships are large, huge, and they take and draw a lot of water, take a lot of room to maneuver, and it's a major issue.
But you, excuse me, Mr. Chair, just to finish this question, but the rail system to support the Port of Portland is adequate or inadequate?
I can't answer
that. At the level of traffic we have now.
I can't answer that for you.
You might have an answer to that question on Wednesday when we have the rail.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Chairman Starr. Just a comment. I believe that one of the biggest reasons that Evergreen is pulling out has to do with the question regarding the dredging of the Columbia River, whether it will happen or won't happen. And that aside, do you know, Mike, who ends up with the ownership of the right-of-ways, the railroad right-of-ways, when they're abandoned? Does the railroad still retain that ownership? Does it go to
the believe answer? That I might have to turn around and look at Claudia and ask her.
It
depends. So maybe that would be a question. You say that on Wednesday you're going to be talking railroads? I think that they could have that answer for you by Wednesday. So that
the heads are nodding, so hopefully that'll happen. Any other questions, Representative Devlin?
Not a question, just a comment. I think in exploring that, what we've always heard in the Portland metropolitan areas is we abandon right-of-ways in most cases, depending upon how it was established, that they revert to the property owners along the right-of-way. So we lose it permanently, actually. That's why we've tried to keep quite a few right-of-ways still in place.
One last question, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much. Not picking on you, Mr. Burroughs. I just, when anybody says this is an individual who focuses on solutions to financing for some of our economic plights, I tend to key into them, and I appreciate Mr. Is it Deister? Mm-hmm. And Mr. Watt coming today. Thank you very much. What other sources of financial assistance or creative financing have you found for our transportation problems? Can you share them with us?
I wish I had the answer for you. However, one of the things that we've talked about is that somebody in the legislature would call for funding a study to look at the different options and find out how it's done in different places across the country. I would have to believe that the cost of our transportation system, our highways in Oregon, are not radically different from the cost of systems in other states. So in terms of dollars, the dollars have to be found someplace. It's just a matter of where you go and what sources you tap in order to create that. Even though we have problems on maintenance on some of our highways, as I travel, and I travel across the country quite frequently, ours are not as bad off as some others, but that doesn't mean you let the highways go, because if you take them and allow them to go too long, then the cost of maintaining them doesn't just double, it quadruples and goes on up, and then you've got the safety issues that go with it. I don't have the answer to your question, but it can be found, I'm sure.
I agree. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to switch to the answer to that. At this time, we're going to move on in our agenda. to House Bill 2178. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2178. John, can you read for us?
Chairman Starr and members of the committee, House Bill 2178 changes conditions under which Oregon Department of Transportation issues vehicle trip permits, allows movement of special use trailer with heavy motor vehicle trip permit, requires statement of insurance coverage prior to issuance of recreational vehicle trip permit, changes time periods and fees for light vehicle trip permit. I'd like members of the committee to note that there is no revenue impact, and just late afternoon yesterday we received a fiscal statement of which all of you should have received. It was delivered to your offices yesterday afternoon. And to particularly note that on the fiscal statement, you will note that for this 2001-2003 biennium, there's a projection of a fiscal impact of over $81,000. For and also note on 2003-2005, there's quite a bit of difference there. So it's something to consider.
Kelly Taylor.
Mr. Chair, do you mind if City of Portland comes to you?
However you want to do it. Flexible. Susan Schneider, City of Portland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just identify yourself. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. And the department requested this bill after, you know, quite a bit of concern over the years that's been raised by both the public, law enforcement, and the news media with some coverage about people abusing trip permits. And by the term, I'm going to explain the difference between trip permits and registration. By abuse, I mean people are illegally obtaining more trip permits than they should by what the law limits. Now, a trip permit can be issued anywhere from 5 to 120 days in length, costing anywhere from $5 to $40. That's different than when you buy a brand new car and the car dealer gives you temporary registration for 90 days while your paperwork's going through before you get your plates. So we're not talking about temporary registration through a dealership. What we're talking about is someone has plates that are expired on their car, and for whatever reason, and I'll talk about that in a minute, they want to move that car along the road but not register it. And so they buy a trip permit to allow them temporary privileges out on the road. That's what a trip permit is. Now, the reason people believe that trip permits are being abused is for a variety of reasons. There are legitimate reasons, so I'll go over those too. We think the abuse stems from avoiding DEQ. Either they've gone to DEQ and their car has failed and they just don't want to fix it or whatever, or flat out don't want to go to begin with. We also think people are buying repeated trip permits because they don't want to register the car. And you think to yourself, now, why would someone not want to register a car in their name? Wouldn't they want to be shown as the owner? Well, quite frankly, criminals and gang members and stuff, that's right. They don't want to be tracked to that car. They don't want someone to know that they own it, and they don't want to buy insurance to go with that car. So a lot of times people buy a short-term little insurance policy, show it to us to get the trip permit, and then go off and cancel it and get money rebated and not have insurance. So there are a lot of bad reasons why people are using trip permits. Now there are some, and I've had members in the past say when this has come up before, well, why don't we just do away with trip permits altogether? Well, before you throw the baby out with the bath, let me tell you, there's a couple of legitimate reasons why people would use trip permits. Frequently, short-term trip permits are purchased when someone is moving out of the state and they don't want to pay full registration. Maybe they've had a car they've been working on in their garage or something and they just want to move to Washington and register it there. So they buy the trip permit just to allow them to drive it legally out of Oregon. Or, again, auto restorers many times have been working on it at their house. Now it's time to go to a professional auto body place, maybe get some body work done or the painting done. Again, not ready to register it for road use full time, so they buy a trip permit to go to and from the paint shop. Okay, or someone is selling a vehicle And it's been sitting around for a while, and they haven't used it, and they don't, again, they don't want to pay the full registration, but they get the trip permit to allow the prospective buyers to do some test drives. So there are some real reasons for trip permits. What this bill suggests is for the trip permits, instead of going anywhere from 5 to 120 days, we tried to find a balance. We tried to think about legitimate use, what they need and what they typically are buying and what and how long they're needing it for, but also come up with some sort of incentive of using trip permits because it's lucrative and you can get away with things for a long period of time. And that's how we came up with two 15-day permits in a year period for a specific car. So that means if I own a vehicle, I can buy two 15-day permits in a 12-month period. Now, let's say that I do use those two trip permits. Maybe I was restoring a car and taking it back and forth to the paint shop and everything, and then I get it going. And so I use my two up. But then I sell the car to, say, Representative Devlin. And for some reason, maybe he gets in a wreck or something or whatever, and he wants to buy trip permits. But it's within that 12-month period, and he goes to DMV and he says, I need to buy a trip permit, and it's a real reason. The clock will reset itself. When the title changes, all owners change on a car, those new owners have a 12-month period to buy it because he may have a legitimate reason for buying a trip permit. So we've tried to think ahead and not say, sorry, Mr. Devlin, you know, Kelly used up the trip permits for that car in this year. But it'd have to be a complete change of ownership, not just different people buying them. That's the bulk of 2178. There are two other pieces that I will touch on. One is special use trailers. A special use trailer is on a construction site. You see sort of what looks like a mobile home or a mobile office. Companies use those as their office. Sometimes they use them for storing tools and equipment. And a lot of times the construction job is a long-term one, and they just need to sometimes move, and so it's going to be there for a long, long time, and they just need to move it one time to another site. They currently would have to register it, pay a whole couple of years' worth of registration for $74, and they've asked us, is there a way for us to once in a while just move it for a less expensive, more economy sort of way to do it? And so we've asked for permission to allow them to use a heavy vehicle trip permit in that instance, to allow a construction company to move it. So they would have two options. Currently they only have one. We thought that sounded reasonable. And then the last piece is to correct something that got dropped in the 97 session. Motor homes, the recreational vehicles, they used to operate under the light vehicle trip permit. And the Parks Department wanted to create a special recreational vehicle trip permit for those people that didn't want to register for a whole 2 years, but maybe just a short term, maybe they just use it on certain weekends, maybe holidays, you know, like the Labor Day, Memorial Day weekends. And so they created a recreational vehicle trip permit to allow that. Okay, that way they still collect money for it and it goes towards parks. But they used to collect, we used to collect insurance information when you bought a motorhome trip permit under light vehicle. And when they created the recreational, that provision got dropped. We believe it was an error. Motorhomes are motor vehicles, and as such, are subject to the motor, to the, you know, financial responsibility insurance law. So we'd like to, we are offering that to be restored. So those are the three main points of the bill. Reducing the curb. Oh, and by the way I lost a whole big piece of it, sorry. What we would propose to do is build a tracking system, because as you'll hear from the gentleman on my far right, he's a retired police officer, we don't have solid data to prove in our files that there's abuse. But we do have stories from law enforcement and the media. I don't know if you saw a recent story on KATU Channel 2. Ed Teachout did a two-night sort of expose. People flat out bragging that they were buying these multiple permits and skirting DEQ. I mean, right to the camera even. Even though they were going to be on TV, they bragged about it. We know that the honor system that's currently in law, saying, Kelly, have you bought more than 120 days in a year, some people are lying and just buying them repeatedly, and there's no way to catch that. We would like to build a tracking system to monitor that and ensure that Kelly doesn't buy more than her two in a year that she's supposed to have. And after that, she either needs to get her car fixed or put it in her name, or whatever reason she's been avoiding it, but she needs to abide by the law like everybody else is doing. And so the tracking system is a vital piece of this proposal. And that would conclude my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Let's have everybody testify and then the first question so we can answer them all.
Good morning, Ms. Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Susan Schneider with the City of Portland Government Relations Office. The City of Portland supports House Bill 2178. With me is retired Police Captain Pat Nelson from the Portland Police Bureau to explain in detail why we support it. In 1995, the City of Portland proposed a very similar bill to this, and it would have passed, but it was one of the shortest sessions on record, and we ran out of time. We sincerely hope that doesn't happen this time. So with that, I would like to introduce...
We'll
hope it's the first session, Mr. Chair, but we'd like to get the bill passed. Well, with that, I'll turn it over to Captain Nelson.
Chair Starr and members of the committee, my name is Captain Pat Nelson, Portland Police Bureau. I'm retired from the Traffic Division. I appreciate this opportunity to appear for you on House Bill 2178. And as Susan said, a couple years ago, legislature tried this, but because of the legislative process, we weren't able to do it. I believe that it's, when I was in uniform, I consistently found individuals were driving on cars with expired trip permits or using trip permits because they had expired plates. And in some cases, they were driving years worth of it. I find that those individuals, when I stop them, they tell me they couldn't pass DEQ, they didn't have insurance, they didn't want to register the car, it really wasn't theirs. There was a long set of excuses, but mostly it was more expensive to fix the car and get rid of the problem than it was to try to register it. So in the past several years, I think that situation has become even more pervasive and common because of the tightening of the DEQ regulations and the number of cars that are brought underneath the auspices of that. I think I see daily cars that have evidence of multiple trip permits in them. The other day I was following the car down the street, it had three expired plates, temporary trip permits in the window, and I went on down around the corner and here was one of them with six sticker pieces across the back window. Officers tell me that they feel in Portland that a 1 in 15 cars has temporary permits. I don't think that's necessarily true, but that's what their feeling is. I would hope that House Bill 2178 had stopped the current practices of the drivers obtaining multiple permits or even worse, extending their own permits. As the current law stands, a permit can be issued up to 120 days, and officers can't easily tell whether or not the permit is good without stopping the car and going up and checking it. And you have to look in behind and see when it was issued and everything. House Bill 2178 would only allow you a permit to be issued for 15 days, and anything in excess of that 15 days would flag the officer's attention so they'd know, wait a minute, you can't have a permit for 30 days out, so it's no good. They'd be able to stop it. Officers have asked me to testify in front of you that not only do the drivers tell them that they're unable to pass DEQ, but they do find a large number of these people, the people in temporary permits, driving with no insurance. What they do is they go out and get a 30-day binder for insurance, go down to DMV, get issued a permit for 120 days, cancel the insurance, and then they've got 120 days of driving around with no insurance. Plus, they don't have a license plate. And so when they get involved in a hit and run or something, off they go. We haven't got a way to find the car. I'd urge you to pass, to stop that practice and pass House Bill 2178. Additionally, I urge the Department of Motor Vehicles to track the temporary permits that are issued. I believe it's important that if possible, that the owner's driver's name, address, and their driver's license and insurance information is put on their permits if we could legally do that. I believe the Department of Motor Vehicles must successfully track these permits and tighten down the process for this law to work, but I would ask you to please pass the bill. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you very much. I know there's a few questions here. The one question I have is there a magic formula that brought us to 15 days?
Mr. Chair, what we looked at is the fact that they can be issued for 5, 10, 30, 60, 90, and 120. And it appeared just anecdotally, again, we don't have solid data. That's unfortunate. The tracking system will give us that. it appears that the legitimate users tend to buy them for short term, maybe 5 or 10 days. So, and that seems to meet their needs. And so we, again, we're trying to balance between making sure the legitimate needs are met. And so we thought 15 actually gives a little cushion for what they've been doing. And yet 15 days is disincentive for someone to try to live on this thing, especially if they're only going to get two. So it was trying to balance legitimate with mostly them being 5 or 10 days, giving them a little cushion and a disincentive for people. So
would it throw a big wrench in a situation if it were 21 days?
You mean like 2 21-day days? Probably not, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, a great idea. Fully support it. I, too, would concur. I think it might be better off to expand the permit duration to 21 days as if people are working during the week and they need to work on their cars, make appointments to get them up to speed for DEQ emissions, and they may have to schedule that. The concept is sound. The issue of a tracking system is also a good idea. However, how are you going to pay for the $111,000?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, that would take an appropriation from the legislature for us to be able to do that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, appropriation from the general fund or expenditures limitation, or what were we thinking?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, no, it would not be general fund. There is, you know, it would have to come from the highway fund dollars that we collect. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I can be clear, if I have a car that's been stored in a garage and it has its license has expired, and I decide, well, I'm going to get it repaired and I'm going to sell it, so I could go and get a temporary permit, drive it to a garage, trip permit, drive it to a garage, hopefully it gets repaired, gets out of the garage, and then I say, well, now I need some time to sell it, so I could go back and I could get the second of the two permits, and I could advertise it in the newspaper. Let's say it doesn't happen to sell. Now, 6 months later, I'm like, well, I really should try again to sell this thing. What is my option at that point to go ahead and get a four-year license registration for the car?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, you would need to register, but you would get a two-year registration. The bill you passed out the other day was only for brand-new vehicles. Everybody else stays at 2 years, and so you would be spending $30 to register it for 2 years.
All right. I think that covers my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Devlin?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Taylor, maybe it'd be helpful to point out to the committee that if the bill passes and goes into law, you also show substantial growth in revenues in terms of people now evading formal registration, now being required to register. So that well offsets your expenditure requirement, just at least the way I read this report.
Mr. Chair and Representative Devlin, you're correct. Again, without solid data, we don't know how many people will turn to legitimate registration. And we've tried to take a guess, but yes, we believe that people will turn to registration, and so that will provide money towards the highway fund like they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Taylor, I can't cite specific figures, but remember when Greg Green was the head of the DEQ Air Quality Division and came here and testified, and I don't know if you have any figures that you can get from DEQ, but sometimes when vehicles are out of compliance, they're way out of compliance, emitting more than 100 times what the vehicle is rated at emitting. And that is a major issue in the metropolitan area in terms of trying to keep an attainment. And I don't know if you had any of those figures, but...
I don't.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't.
Ms. Berger?
I live in Salem, and I want to get a trip permit. Would you describe for me exactly what happens at the counter when I apply for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, you would need to show proof of insurance for that vehicle and pay some money, and then a simple permit is issued to you with a particular expiration date, depending on how long of a permit you applied for.
A follow-up, please. Yeah. What information do you gain from me? My name? My address?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, today I don't believe we get address, I think just name, but I'm honestly not positive. I have to get back to you on that.
So I would be able then to use my permits here in Salem, and then I could go to another DMV?
Mr. Chair and Representative Verger, today that is what's happening, because they're not tracked at all, not to the person, not to the car. You can just come in and buy them over and over again. That is what's happening today. You're right, Representative Verger.
Mm-hmm. That's really a poor system.
Yeah. Yeah. We, Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, we agree. That's why we want to change it.
Any other kind of Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make sure I understood the change in the fees. Currently, it's $5 for a 10-day permit, as I understand it, and we would be going to $20 for a 15-day permit.
Mr. Chair and Representative Merkley, yes. Today, for a 10-day permit, you pay $5, $10 for 30 days, $20 for 60 days, $30 for 90, and $40 for 6 months. And this bill is suggesting that for the 15-day permit, it be $20. Now, if you all change it to 21, I don't know if you want to change the $20 or not. Again, we're trying to balance, you know, the...
So in essence, for the legitimate short-term user, we're going from 50 cents a day to about $1.30 a day. So it's rough, a little bit more than 2.5 times increase in the fee, in essence.
If they were buying, Mr. Chair, Representative Virgil, if they were buying just 1 5-day, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 1 10-day.
Sure. 10-day. Right. 1 10-day. Right.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Tim Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But Ms. Taylor, it sounds like there's no impact, but the impact of issuing the permit in terms of the amount of employee time, processing and all, is the same for a 10-day permit as it'll be for a 21-day permit. And so we want to be careful that our fee at least covers the cost of issuing the permit, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dillon, you're correct. In fact, under this bill with a tracking system, I believe the transaction will actually take a little longer, because today it's a pretty simple thing to just fill a little piece of paper out and hand you, but we are going to have the tracking system, so we'll be keying in some information. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, Representative Verger.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I have a question more for you and the committee. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money for the tracking system, where you're looking at really a tight budget, and the way the system has worked so far, there's been really no in-depth or limitations. For instance, if I lived in Salem, then I couldn't go anywhere else. I would have to give my address, and I couldn't get another one. I'm just wondering if there isn't a simpler, less expensive way of tracking rather than this kind of expenditure, but that's just a comment for the committee.
That's a good question.
Mr. Chair, I have a question also.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, what's your time frame for completion of the tracking system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, I believe this bill would take effect January 1, 2002. I don't know how long it would take us to finish. It's about 1,000 hours, 1,100 hours of programming. I would imagine it would take us a few months to get it up and running. I mean, we'd have to have it up by January 1 of 2002, so by the time you all left town, we'd start working on it, and we'd have it up by January 1 of 2002.
Mr. Chair,
may I ask Representative Verger? I wasn't really following her. Representative Verger, could you run through that through me again? I was trying to follow what you were saying, and I'm not sure I understood.
I think we tend to want to go to technology because it is nice and wonderful and all those good things, and it's one of those easier ways to do it. But I'm thinking where we're trying to cut costs so severely. The system that you have today, and you agree that it's so poor. I mean, it's no tracking, no address, don't know where I live. It seems to me that if there were limitations on what I could do, if you take my name and address, and then I can only go to a certain DMV to get that, it's real easy. You know, you have a list. I came in November, and I came in January, and I've used up my two times.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, thank you. I appreciate that. But see, Representative Verger, even if we limited you to the same office, we would need some sort of way to track you to know that you were there in April and November. A manual list would not work. I don't believe it would be feasible. That's why we would want to build the automated tracking system.
Okay. I don't want to, you know, yin-yang here, but I just... Why wouldn't you? I mean, we've done these things for years without technology and tracking systems, so it seems like a simple thing to know if I've come in your office.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, you're right. We have done this for years, and it doesn't work. The honor system hasn't worked, and we believe that that we're losing money towards the highway fund to help not have such a flat budget, not have to make cuts. And we believe that people are driving uninsured on these things, and so we're firmly convinced that unless we invest in the tracking system, an honor system and a paper system will not work.
Well, I think you're right in that, you know, I would love for the honor system to work.
I would,
boy,
too.
That would mean you and I were living in a great place.
Yes.
But since it doesn't, I'm just wondering if there's not a simpler paper way to do it if we weren't able to afford the tracking system at this time. That's just,
I don't know.
My sense is that it would take more staff time to actually handwrite and to write out or to do a paper file than it would be to look it up on the computer. The initial investment is great, but once the investment is made for the future, the cost is very minimal.
And Mr. Chair, I would agree, and we're currently issuing about 850,000 permits in a biennium.
Wow.
So
that's
a lot of handwriting.
Yeah. Committee members, this bill does have to go to Ways and Means because of the fiscal, so if Ways and Means folks will get their crack at it, they'll be able to, and Kelly will have a chance to explain that the numbers they have are good, and she'll withstand that.
Yeah.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Taylor?
Yes.
I'm concerned, so I get a trip permit, and I drive over to Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
You tracking me over there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, today, no.
Tomorrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I don't know what all the tracking system will contain, but it should contain enough information to know that we've issued you a trip permit.
So, excuse me, but this would be, we'd have reciprocity with that state. I mean, I could just see this going on and on. We've got to include 50 states and...
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, today there's reciprocity. You're allowed to drive across the border with the trip permit, yes.
But you're not going to track me I can do the same thing in Idaho and continue to the East Coast, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I don't know whether Idaho would sell you a trip permit to continue on or not.
Just the tracking portion of this. I'm
right.
curious about that. And,
yeah.
and also, on the... uninsured motorist issue, which is very precious and close to my heart, because we don't have a solution yet to handling uninsured motorists because of this temporary period for which you can get, you know, an insurance binder or an insurance policy and cancel it 30 days to avoid another fine. What is this a solution? I mean, we keep issuing fines, but we don't resolve this issue. I have a client or constituent, I guess I should say, who, you know, three times has been hit by an uninsured motorist. And, I mean, this just continues. So, you know, while this may help us find out, you know, who's driving uninsured, we don't have a solution to the problem. Is there a solution?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative, I thought you were making a statement. I didn't know that was a question.
I'm sorry. Mr. Nelson, then.
What I was going to say is, you're right. The legislature has put several tools in place. One of them is vehicle confiscation, impoundment, not confiscation. I will say that something that the legislature started with a few sessions ago is this close to coming up. It will come up the end of March. We are currently testing it with law enforcement right now, and that is a linkage between insurance company records and DMV records. And insurance companies are reporting to us as policies are renewed or issued or canceled, and we are going to be placing that on the vehicle record, saying that insurance is or is not on file, and that will be a very important tool for law enforcement out there in the field.
Follow up, please, Ms. Chairman. My question regarding that is, you know, having been a part of a number of applications for tracking systems of aircraft and automobiles and in business, I just wondered if we couldn't be, you know, one of the measures of efficiency and economy we could bring about, like Representative Verger is asking us to do, is to include many of these processes in one tracking system. I mean, so the same information isn't then collected in another purpose or through another bill or continuous. And I'm concerned that we keep developing computer programs for one application rather than looking at the system as a whole, which would bring us greater efficiency, but most, you know, importantly, obtain the results more economically.
Mm-hmm. I understand what you're saying, Representative Nelson.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on House Bill 2178? Anyone have to their feet? We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2178 and open a work session on House Bill 2178.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to propose a conceptual amendment on to House Bill 2178, page number 1, line 29, to strike the number 15 and change that to the number 21.
Is there any discussion on the motion, Representative Dillon?
Mr. Chairman, just for future reference, to know what you've been told by Legislative Council in the previous session, it was normal for us to be able to simply change numbers and things like that, but if we add any text amendment, it would have to be reviewed by Legislative Council. And are we're under the same?
Under the same rule. Add those to change the numbers, a different rule.
Does that take a formal amendment then, or?
This will be fine.
This will be fine in this.
Okay.
Any other discussion on that? Representative Nelson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Back to my concern on the cost of developing one more computer tracking system within state government and the cost of it. You know, it seems to me that, you know, with this bill could come a recommendation that we see how this system could be combined, as in we just heard of another system that could be used for many applications rather than one more separate standalone system.
That's a good recommendation. My understanding is that Representative Hill, in the whole sphere of technology, is looking at some of those issues in his technology committee. But I would also recommend that Kelly take that comment to heart as she goes through Ways and Means and have the discussions about how the dollars are going to be spent. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Kelly, from where she's at, could just nod her head. But wouldn't the tracking system that you're talking about be a modification to your existing software? It's not actually a separate, and it's one of the problems that we face in all agencies. Every time we do anything, we have to modify the existing software. And I hope you're not written, your software isn't in some old language like COBOL.
She's looking around. That's not good, Representative.
But that's usually what we're doing. We're not actually developing a separate software program. We're going back and modifying the existing.
And I think she pointed that out in her testimony because she was saying it would take somewhere around 1,000 or 1,100 hours of programming. So that would seem to indicate that existing system.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I strongly support the amendment to change the time to 21 days. I know, and I have simple chores around the house that seem to take 21 days to accomplish. And
you too?
You're fascinating.
Three or four reminders from my partner, my wife, and I think in the process of people trying to get a car repaired to get it on the road or trying to sell it, have their ad in the paper for a few weeks, so it gives a little more flexibility. So I do strongly support that. I did want to just mention, while the department was here, that this issue of police officers being able to identify whether a permit is valid or not, if we were on a 30-day permit system, which isn't so long, the color of each permit could be different, and then there'd only be at any one point. Police officers could easily identify that you have an expired permit in your window. But maybe that's for next session. Thank you.
Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
I like very much the suggestion of 30 days and or a month because, you know, being an individual who works full-time, you know, you have four precious days of, you know, when you possibly could get help since most businesses are closed on Sunday. It gives you 4 days if you're a full-time working individual, and, you know, I think that would give an individual the right amount of time. It's really, you know, probably 4 days. And also I'm concerned about the point of a hardship waiver. And I'm well aware that this occurs in this very instant because there are individuals who find themselves in circumstances where, because of an economic issue that, you know, a vehicle needs to be moved and there are no funds, and they need the sale of that vehicle in order to continue to support their family or for sustenance. So I would ask for that inclusion.
So are you you're saying that you don't support the 21 days, you'd like to see 30 days?
Yes, I would.
Okay. Any other discussion on Representative Krupp's motion? Seeing none, I'll have a roll call vote on this motion.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Dublin?
Aye.
Huff.
Aye.
Merkley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Nay.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Donner?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Devlin?
Mr. Chairman, I move 2178 to the Ways and Means Committee with the recommendation to pass.
As amended. Very good.
There's
a motion on the floor to move House Bill 2178 as amendment to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, could...
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something for my own edification. Well, did this originally have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
No, it did not. But when we got the fiscal back, we because it's more than $50,000, that's kind of the threshold. We have to send it there. We don't really have a choice.
So that's basically an automatic.
So then, Kelly, we'll have to go talk to the folks in there to make sure that the money for this and move from there on to the process.
Okay, thank you.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Merkley.
I'd just like to say I'm sympathetic to the position that my colleague to the left took on the timing, because when people do have cars who are trying to get back on the road, it often requires, I grew up in a neighborhood where people worked on cars a lot, I tell you, it takes a lot more than a short period of time to be testing them out and getting them approved pollution controls. And I'd like to see how this, if this proceeds in this manner, I'd like to see how it works. But a lot of families that to have to go out and get even a two-year registration in order to get a car sold just seems like an unnecessary. We have a problem now, but maybe we're going too far the other direction and making it just too hard for people to conduct ordinary affairs of life. And so certainly be willing to be in conversation with you 2 years from now if this proceeds like this, to see if we need to loosen it up a little bit.
We can adjust it certainly in the future. Any further discussion? See, now, can we have a vote, please, on the motion?
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Devlin?
Aye.
Krupp?
Aye.
Merkley?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Donner?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Motion passes. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2178. And there's no other business before the committee. We are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.